Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuimange Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuimangeInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. You've heard of the kahuna, a Hawaiian shaman. The huna tradition is a very deep one, and we'll be talking with Serge Kahili King, who's the author of Mastering Your Hidden Self, A Guide to the Huna Way. He says that the most fundamental idea in huna philosophy is that each of us creates our own experience of reality by our beliefs, and that it's not that our reality is created as a result of our personal expressions, but that we are co-creators with the universe itself. And huna is about learning to become a conscious co-creator. Serge joins us from Kauai, Hawaii. Hello.
Aloha.
Aloha. And aloha means?
Aloha is a Hawaiian word that means love. And we use it for hello and goodbye.
Serge, how long have you been in Hawaii, and how did you come to study so deeply the huna way?
Well, I've been living here permanently for about 14 years. My beginnings actually began with my father. In the beginning of the last century, he was adopted by a Hawaiian family and trained in their knowledge of a particular healing tradition. And then later, when I was old enough, when I was 15, well, he introduced me to the path. And the same family, when my father died, they adopted me. I was adopted as a grandson. I continued training with them.
How much of the huna way from its deep history to the present is intact?
Well, in my family's tradition, my Hawaiian family's tradition, it's completely intact because it was based on some very simple principles.
And what were those principles?
Well, there's seven ideas about life that we use, that the world is what you think it is. There are no limits. Energy flows where attention goes. Now is the moment of power. To love is to be happy with. All power comes from within. And effectiveness is the measure of truth.
Oh, those are good ones.
Yeah.
Let's look at each of those individually. The world is what we think it is.
That's right. Now, the only experience we can have of the world is the experience we have that comes through our own ideas about it. So we're always experiencing what we think we know to be true, what we believe, what we fear, what we desire. And so... if this is our experience, we're not talking about some external reality. We're talking about your experience of that reality. Well, you can change how you think and therefore change your experience.
Makes sense. And so that has to do with the very deep look into the subconscious, the conscious mind, and then the superconscious mind that
That's
the
right.
huna way goes into. And that's pretty much how we see it today. That's why we call it the subconscious mind, the conscious mind, the superconscious mind, or God mind, I guess. Tell us more.
Well, then the next principle says there are no limits, and this implies two things. One, that the universe is infinite, and that means both that we are connected with everything. In other words, there's a mutual influence going on all the time,
mm-hmm.
and also that anything is possible. But this is a practical philosophy, and so we add to that, anything is possible if you can figure out how to do it.
Okay.
We see this in human development,
mm-hmm.
where at certain times something is considered impossible, like heavier-than-air flight or running a four-minute mile, things like that. And then some human beings find out how to do it, going to the moon, all those kinds of things.
And then it becomes...
and it's no longer impossible. So... that's what this idea says.
Well, there are traditions of kahunas who could influence the weather, who could talk to animals.
Oh,
so
sure.
This would be due to that mutual influence. We're all connected to the same
That's the concept that we use, yes.
Okay. Have you witnessed any of those abilities?
Well, I was
trained
how to do it.
Uh-huh.
I have to remember that what it is influence, not control.
Right.
So, yes, influence.
You could see it also as communication then, couldn't you?
That's what it is.
Too. Mm-hmm. So.
Because the basic idea is that everything is alive, and we find this among many peoples of the world, but everything is alive, and therefore, if you can learn to speak its language, you can communicate with it and make friends with it, and it'll help you do what you want to do to the best of its ability.
So to communicate with the weather, for example, is
right.
it in the form of a prayer, in the form of visualization, in the form of what?
Well, all of these things are simply ways of focusing your intent.
Right.
Your intention. And it gets translated, you might say subconsciously, into whatever form of understanding the thing is that you're communicating with. So if I'm talking to the wind, I can do it as a formal prayer if I want to, but I can also just say, hello, wind. Hey, how would you like to blow from this direction for a while? And I can imagine a picture of that, which will help me focus my intention more clearly. And if I have a good friendship with the wind, why, and it's within the realm of possibility for the wind at that moment, why, you know, it'll usually do what I like.
And to develop a good friendship with the wind or the sharks or the whatever,
right.
what does that mean in the Huna tradition?
It really is no different from friendship with a human being.
Mm-hmm. Pay it attention, respect.
That's right. Attention, respect, also help.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we forget that it's not that we are, you know, getting powers from these things. We also have to share. We also have to help, but we also have to have tolerance. In other words, sometimes the wind just has other things to do and can't do what I want. Well, if a friend is that way, why, you know, and if you are a friend, you tolerate that. You say, okay, well, okay, I understand. Next time.
Yeah. So, as children, we used to have these, I don't know, exercises outdoors where we'd sort of lay in the grass, look up at a nice little fluffy white cloud, and breathe it out.
Yes.
And it would just disappear on us. And we all did this and could all do this successfully.
Well, that's the same kind of thing. When we have much more influence on our environment than we realize. Children's games are one way in which to do this without question and just as fun.
Well, you're just sort of experimenting. You're testing
your. So you don't have, you might wonder whether it's going to work, but you don't have any active doubt.
We would watch certain clouds go by, and then sometimes we'd breathe them and make them disappear. That's how we
right.
called it. I don't know really how you do it.
You can
just focus on it.
You can also look at a blank piece of sky.
Yeah.
And have a cloud form there.
Condense one right there. And this was with small clouds we could do this, not with
big
ones.
That's easier. Yeah. Partly it's easier because of our belief and expectation, partly it's easier because it helps us focus more clearly.
So many people communicate with animals in the Huna way. What is that experience like?
Animals seem to either relate better to imagery, or imagery is a better for us as a means of communication, one or the other.
The language of symbol, you mean?
The language of symbols, that's
uh-huh,
right.
Okay.
And they respond to that better than they do to words. So words might be used to help your focus, but maybe it's possible that they think more in symbolic terms as well.
Interesting. Well, so does our soul, it seems to me. Speak in symbolic terms.
There's a lot more content.
I think it's our primary language. Yeah.
Right.
So, well, tell me about an experience of communicating with an animal.
One time I was hiking with my wife. We used to walk along a particular road, and there was a very mean and angry dog would come rushing out always and bar the path and threaten us. Well, one day, I was not in a good mood. That happened in those days occasionally. And so he came rushing out, and I imagined a huge wolf by my side. growling at this dog. And right there in front, the dog stopped, tucked its tail in, and ran whimpering back to its house. Now, I felt bad about that. So I decided there had to be a better way to do it than that. So next time we came along that road and the dog started to come out, started barking the same way, why, what I imagined was the dog's master. I didn't have to have a particular face or sex. I didn't know. But I imagined the dog's master petting it, comforting it. And the dog immediately quieted down and didn't even bother coming out on the street. It wasn't afraid because when we passed it, it was sitting there calmly. And so that was a much better way to communicate. But interestingly, both of them had an effect.
Yvette, Paul, my husband Paul and I, on our last visit to Hawaii, went to some little tiny museum somewhere, and there was a Hawaiian native there, and we had a long chat with him, and there was nobody in the museum, so we had some time to chat with him, and he was telling us about his ancestors and how they had a relationship in his family group with sharks. And he said that they would go out, and when they were fishing, one of them would communicate with the sharks and ask them to please stay away and not eat them, I guess. So a long family tradition, and he said he was very sad to have lost that.
Yeah, there are a lot of, first of all, different Hawaiian families will have different, they'll have relationships with different animals.
That's what he said, yeah.
Yes, right. And every possible animal in Hawaii has some family connection. But it's lost because, there's a lot of reasons for it, but in many cases, the people who had the knowledge either didn't pass it on because Hawaiian culture was suppressed for quite a while.
Right.
They either didn't pass it on or it was, you know, the people died without an interest in the children. But fortunately, there's still quite a bit of knowledge left.
I think
still
so.
Quite a bit of passing on.
Yeah.
Not all, very little of it public.
Well, he said it sounds crazy to some people, and Paul and I said, no, it doesn't sound crazy at all to us.
No, right, so, right. But to a lot of mainstream people, it still does.
Energy, what's the next of the seven principles?
The third principle. Yeah, the third principle, very, very useful. It says that energy flows where attention goes. And this is wherever you put your attention, your energy begins flowing in that direction. Now, this can be applied to healing the body. It can be applied to healing or changing circumstances. Learning how to keep your focus on what you want instead of on what you don't want is a very important skill.
I think so. So.
And if you keep your attention focused on something, let's say a project or a plan, why then it starts to attract other people's energy.
Seems to open doorways, doesn't it, rather miraculously?
Yes, that's right. And then things begin to happen if you keep the focus.
Another principle, another way to use that is to start acting and taking the steps as though the path was already open, that the goal was already in grasp.
Yes, and what's happening there really has a lot to do with the next principle, which is that now is the moment of power.
Uh-huh.
If you start thinking as if the success has already been gained, then you are altering your present pattern of action and reaction and expectation.
Now is the moment of power. So many of us are trained to look to history.
Yes.
As where the power lay, or the direction was set, or the mold was made.
That's right. And really, history is no more than present moment memories.
Huh.
You can't touch yesterday. There are ways to shift into that time, but then it becomes the present moment. From where we're at, all we're working with is memory. And they exist now. Well, you can change your response to those memories, and thereby radically change your mind, body, and experience. And if you're daring enough, you can even change the memories and have a different reaction and response, mind, body, and circumstance.
And that's where you go to the subconscious mind and communicate with it.
That's right.
Because it's the one that holds the memories.
So all we're relating to, you know, when we think we're relating to past or past events, we're only relating to the memory of those events.
So you get the impression here, and now is the moment of power, of almost like the amount of energy that's contained within an atom or the space between atoms. So much, if you just know how to tap it.
That's exactly it. There's unlimited energy right here in this present moment.
So how do you tap that? How do you harness that?
Well, the simple explanation is with intention.
Okay.
And expectation. It really is that simple. The thing that gets in the way, of course, are all the doubts and all the fears. And
the conditioning.
That kind of stuff, right.
Yeah.
But intention and expectation is what does it.
Can you give us an example?
Well, for instance, as an example, sometimes human beings, it's easier for human beings to have some sort of technique. Sometimes it's called a ritual, sometimes it's called a process, but you know, that helps them focus their attention. Well, we have one that I've developed called Dynamind, and works by working in the present moment, clarifying your intention, building your expectation, moving energy and relaxing the doubts and fears and tensions, why we have incredible changes in people. People will be walking around with 5 years of pain or dysfunction, and it can be gone in an instant. Sometimes it takes longer because there's more aspects to it to change, but the physical body can change in a very, very short time when the focus is shifted.
It's amazing how malleable we are, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
So what's an example of the physical body responding to a change in the mindset? We've heard the famous...
Well, let me give you one example recently.
Sure.
where I was helping a woman, and she had a broken shoulder and pain from that broken shoulder. Okay. Then she'd had it for 9 months. So by helping her shift her focus in the present moment, shifting to a different intention and expectation. Less than a minute. Might have been a little longer than 30 seconds, but it was well less than a minute. Why, the pain was gone, and the shoulder moved into place all by itself.
So why are we so attached to the idea that this can't happen? If this has been our experience, if this has been our potential, if we've lived this fully in the past through some of these wisdom traditions, what's with us today? Is it the lock into...
What's with us today is a huge emphasis, this is a cultural emphasis, on the past as an influence in our lives. And we are, in a way, culturally trained, or at least, you know, the habit is there. It's not active training usually, but the cultural idea of how important the past is, and how when we search for, people are taught to search for cause and effect, with the cause being in the past, and with the idea that that can't be changed.
We also have this idea of it's a what you see is what you get physical reality out here, so that the physical holds so much more weight than the mind does.
Yeah, it's seen as a something so tangible and so immovable, or so difficult to move and change. And it's that kind of expectation that really gets in the way.
Yeah, and then the leading edge of science telling us it's all a vibration anyway would seem much easier to move or change
actually,
a vibration.
No, if we use some of the scientific ideas, why you know, some of them are so close to ancient modes of thought.
Uh-huh, isn't that exciting?
But they haven't permeated the practical level of society. Everything is vibration. Well, that's nice, but then we keep treating things as solid objects.
Some of the newest science I've heard is that rather than looking to the quantum subatomic realm for the quantum physics effects, they're now starting to recognize that it's happening in this dimension as well.
Well, sure. I mean, if it's energy at the deepest level, it's energy at every level.
What's the next principle?
The next one says that to love is to be happy with. And it sounds, well, it is an observation, but there's some very profound implications.
Okay.
The idea here is that this is a direct translation of the roots of the word aloha. And it says that this is what love is. Love is when you are happy with someone or with something. And when you're not happy, you're not loving. It makes it really simple and clear. The implication, the deeper implication, is that when you are loving, why then that's the stage or the state in which it is easier to change something. So sometimes we put it this way, you know, if you want to change your life, why first make peace with the present.
Makes sense.
And then it's much easier. And this has to do with making peace with it means freeing yourself from all judgment about it and looking at it creatively and if not joyfully, at least without anger and resistance and fear.
Mm-hmm. And the next one?
The next one says that all power comes from within. And this derives from the second principle, which says that the universe is infinite. Now, if the universe is infinite, then all the power of the universe is everywhere, and that includes inside each one of us. So we are the ones who have the authority over every aspect of our lives. And when we, actually, it's kind of strange, when we apparently give up that authority, we're actually using our authority to do that.
This is such an interesting paradox.
We can change from within. Now, we can get help from without. So here's one of the practical ways of looking at it. Healers don't heal. No matter how great they are, how much energy they have, how powerful they seem to be or say they are, the healing always comes from within.
Yeah.
Healers help when they are effective. They help that happen.
So there's two modes of thought in this. One is that the patient is actually healing themselves because they're
right.
The one that's changing their physical body and
exactly.
Motivating the healing power within and releasing the placebo effect or what have you.
That's right.
And
that's
the healer is just the... Uh-huh. Or you could say that our creator is the one that's doing the healing. And
you
it's,
could do that, but then the creator is within too, if we assume that it's infinite.
Right.
You can call the source whatever you want.
It's the same thing.
But the healer is only helping.
So this relationship of outside help to inside help?
Yeah, you know, it depends on how you want to look at it. You can think of it as inside help or outside help, and that can be useful. We have a phrase that says that separation can be a useful illusion.
Oh, I like that.
But you can also look at it, say, when I'm asking for outside help, I'm really asking another part of myself.
Yeah, that's contriving to make it possible, and we just give it this name. Yeah. And effectiveness is the true measure?
Effectiveness is the measure of truth.
Okay.
And this says that what matters is not what other people say is the truth or what is called the truth. What matters is what works.
Right.
And when we say what works, we're talking about in terms of harmonious happenings and outcomes.
It's rather
the same word used for this last principle, pono, has the concept of goodness, harmony.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't matter. We're not interested in an absolute truth. We're interested in what works. If you believe that telepathy is helping you to heal or change your life, and it works, then that's truth for you.
And for heaven's sakes, keep using it, because it's a useful tool.
As long as it works.
Yeah.
Of course.
We continue our conversation with Serge King, author of Mastering Your Hidden Self, A Guide to the Huna Way. Serge, so much of the Huna philosophy centers on this understanding of the conscious mind, the subconscious mind, and the superconscious mind, and how to align the three for a more harmonious and happier and effective life. What is the ancient Huna understanding of the subconscious? Let's start there and compare that to modern psychology's understanding of the subconscious.
It's somewhat different because the Hawaiian understanding equates the subconscious to what we might call the body consciousness. You can't really separate it out from the body as something distinct from it. So the body has an awareness, the body has motivations, and holds the memory, This is how we look at that. Subconscious is when we use that term, it's only to help people in the modern world get an understanding of what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the conscious mind, can think of that as the intellect or just mind itself, not directly connected to the body or physical things.
And how did the Huna see the subconscious and conscious mind?
From the Huna perspective, let's call it the subconscious. The subconscious is that part of you which holds memories and which has the motivation to move toward pleasure and away from pain. And that motivated all of its behavior.
Oh, it's a survival mechanism.
It's not just survival. When survival is taken care of, then that motivates all the other body's behavior. Anything, it'll move toward anything that provides sensory emotional pleasure.
You point out that Freud felt that the subconscious mind was inherently bad, and the Huna tradition sees it as inherently good.
That's right. Because Freud used a concept that he called the id, which for him was the repository for all of our negative impulses. And Jung translated this into the concept of the shadow, which was very close to the same thing. But we just don't look at it that way. Subconscious, of course, is good because everything it does to try and help or protect the whole self, even illness. An attempt to solve a problem.
How is illness an attempt to solve a problem?
Well, it's always the body's or the subconscious way of trying to cope with a stressful situation. And in the coping of that situation, very often what the body does is try to protect by tensing up, by creating tension, in order to protect against bad feelings, bad memories, bad situations, but the consequences of that tension are what produce the illness. And sometimes the subconscious will use an illness to get a person out of a stressful work situation or family situation, for instance.
Back to Freud's feeling that the subconscious was inherently bad, as opposed to the Huna, who think it's inherently good. Wouldn't the Freud and the Jungian just naturally derive from a culture which believed in original sin, so believed that we start out bad and we have to work really hard to be good, as opposed to the indigenous wisdom, which is we're all part of the Creator, it's all good to begin with?
I really don't think that was their idea. I think that they looked at the fact that human beings do have negative feelings, motivations, and behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did in a way was personify that as a means of dealing with it. Because much of the Western medical and treatment tradition looks at what's wrong and tries to get rid of it.
Right. Seek and destroy.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
As opposed to heal and integrate.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I think it has more to do with that than the influence of the original sin concept. Although the idea of illness as evilness, I'm sure that has permeated the Western medical outlook.
How in the Huna tradition does one align the subconscious and the conscious mind for greater harmony, and then align that to the superconscious. And let's describe the superconscious. We haven't done that yet.
Okay. Well, where would you like to start with all of that?
Let's define the superconscious first.
All right, let's talk about that. Here, when each of these selves, as we look at it in my family tradition, okay, as we look at it, each of these selves has a role to play in the whole self. They're all part of your same self, just like your head and your hands and your feet have different roles to play. So do these others. And the role of the superconscious, we can call it, higher self, we also use that term, Hawaiian aumakua, is creative. In other words, it inspires. It inspires with energy and inspires with ideas. And that's its role. And I think that these selves are better defined by their roles. The conscious mind, then, its role is to choose.
To choose? Okay. To discern, to discriminate, to...
That's right.
To lead, okay.
Choose the focus.
Mm-hmm.
And the role of the
subconscious mind, you said,
mind,
was
then,
to...
is to feel, to relate experience.
Ah, okay. And so that's why naturally it would seek positive, pleasurable experiences.
Well, that's why naturally it moves in that direction whenever it can.
Mm-hmm.
When it can't, or believes that it can't, or doesn't have any direction from the conscious mind, then it'll move to the least painful.
Okay. And what's the goal of the superconscious or the higher self?
Now, the goal of the superconscious, the way we look at it, is harmony.
Mm-hmm.
But what it does is it harmonizes beliefs, memory-based beliefs, and expectations of these memory-based beliefs of the subconscious mind, expectations of the conscious mind, and harmonizes those into our current experience. But it, even when it does that, it's seeking to make that more harmonious. That's where the inspiration comes in. Inspiration then can come from inside as ideas rising up, or it can come from external, what appear to be external sources. Like when you walk into a bookstore and you're in need of guidance and a book falls into your lap.
Uh-huh.
So that book experience is very, very common.
Uh-huh.
And it's because we give a lot of authority to books, and so the higher self uses that as a means to communicate.
What are some other stories of inspiration that you've heard?
Well, you know, some of the things I ask people are, has anybody ever turned on the television and just at that moment they receive guidance?
Oh, yes, or the radio.
That happens a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. They get it from movies. They get it from novels. They get it from overheard conversations. One time, I was particularly asking for guidance for a very important lecture I had to give, and my trying to decide whether to give it on love or power. And when I went out for lunch that afternoon, I was driving to the restaurant, a building that I had passed many times, and I noticed for the first time, all over the whole side of the building, it said, "Love is the greatest."
There was your answer.
There was my answer. And what was most important was, whether the high self painted it there or not, it doesn't really matter. It felt like the answer.
Right.
And that's what I used, and it was very successful. So we can receive inspiration from all sorts of directions.
All right, just listening to your own intuition is often a great source, too.
Often that works, too, if you're relaxed enough.
So what are some of the HUNA techniques to integrate these three aspects of ourself?
Well, I just mentioned one of the most important, and that's relaxation.
Uh-huh.
And the reason it is so important is because in our society we give ourselves over to an excess of tension, and we maintain that tension excessively. And so the more tension we have, and you can call it stress if you want, but the more tension we have, the more out of touch we are, both with our body, our subconscious, and our superconscious, and even our environment. So relaxation is one of the primary things. The second one is learning, taking it from that third principle, learning how to focus on what you want and not on what you don't want. And those two things taken together will go a long way to always helping to bring yourself back into harmony, clear thinking, better health and success.
Now, it's been said that the subconscious mind does not understand the difference between a positive statement and its negative form of the statement. It'll interpret the I don't want this as I want this. It'll just see the goal.
I know what people say that, but it
people say
isn't
that.
So.
Okay, so I was going to ask you to clarify this.
A lot of observation has demonstrated that. A lot of observation and experimentation has demonstrated that. What the subconscious does is relate to the intention. Now, if, for instance, one of the most powerful healing statements a friend of mine developed was when he had asthma, he said, I don't have asthma, I never have had asthma, I never will have asthma.
And that was effective.
It was effective. It took him a while. It might have not have taken so long if he had altered the statement because he was really pushing against something he didn't want, but the intention was perceived, and it took him 6 months of constantly repeating that, but his asthma was gone.
Well, if he had said, I can breathe free and easy, something like that, a more positive statement, do you think it would have worked better? Because then his...
It might have, but you see, what really matters is,
what works.
In addition to the intention, is the motivation.
Mm-hmm. That asthma really bugged him, so he was motivated.
He wanted to be rid of the asthma. That was his powerful motivation.
But isn't that focusing on what you don't want rather than what you do want?
Yes, it certainly was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the most efficient way. So if he could have found an equally motivating statement that was expressed in positive terms, then that would have worked for him.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, that would depend on what worked for him in particular. The only thing he could think of, he had no training in positive thinking or metaphysics or anything else. He just knew what he didn't want. My main point is, yes, it could have been done better, probably, but at the time, that's what he wanted.
And that's all he had to work with.
And it worked.
Yeah. After 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not bad for a lifetime of asthma, actually.
Well, I had terrible allergies until one day I said, this is ridiculous. I don't need these anymore. And I had observed that, that we really create these things through our fears or through our believing that we're so sensitive or whatever. After I observed somebody who was environmentally sensitive,
Yes. And
a friend took me out to see this guy, and he was out living in the middle of the country, and you couldn't approach him with perfume or
right.
You know, anything with formaldehyde, and he had to have everything packaged, and he lived in sort of this little bubble and all of this. I thought, oh, my God, anybody who's sensitive, you know, to chemicals and who can sniff them in the air and who's going to be allergic to them, I just said, that's the end result of this path that I'm on by being sensitive and, mm-hmm. and allergic. So I said, I don't want any of this, and it stopped.
Yeah, right.
As I observed, he made himself sick by his fear of the world.
Right, exactly. I know many people like that.
Yeah. So I just saw that clearly. That.
But also I know many people who did what you did. Total shift of focus.
Right. And I just sort of declared, I'm free of this sensitivity. I'll be sensitive where it's useful for me, but not to where it's useful.
In most cases, it is as simple as that. This is one of the hardest parts about Puna and about teaching it. It's so simple, people have a hard time believing it.
I see. We expect things to be complicated, the no pain, no gain idea.
Right.
So you were, at what age did you start in all of this Huna tradition?
Formally, I really started when I was 14. Of course, in my family, we grew up playing psychic games without even thinking about it. But the formal choice, I was offered, and I made my decision when I was 15.
So what did formal training consist of?
Well, it's actually pretty informal.
Had that feeling.
Yeah. It consists of, in our family tradition, it consists of giving the apprentice, let's call it, some ideas to work with.
Okay.
For instance, I was given ideas to work with and to think about, and then it was up to me to go and explore those and come back for feedback with questions.
Yeah.
And I only learned as much as my questions would allow.
Ah.
So we were taught early on the In our tradition, initiative is extremely important, highly valued. So it was my questions that took me in the direction that I went.
Now, see, isn't this how education should be?
I think so.
I think so, too.
Worked very well for me.
Yep.
I happen to have a very curious mind, and so I asked a lot of questions.
Yep. How old is the Huna tradition? It can't be situated just to Hawaii,
Not at all.
It's a very, very vast...
Yeah, we find these ideas everywhere. But, you know, here's the problem, and this is a very Western concept, when we say how old it is. The assumption is that a given number of years are very important. Well, when you have an oral tradition, like the Hawaiian and many others, you don't think in those terms. So Hawaiians, you know, they didn't count the years. First of all, they had a lunar calendar. But the number of years for any particular thing were just not important. Anything we have today that says when they were here is all guesswork. They just didn't consider that important. They had legends and tales and traditions and histories and genealogies, but not in terms of years. So we actually had, there's no way, because there's no reference point to tell how long ago. We have indications that there were people in the islands at the time when the they were volcanically active. This does not correspond to Western geological ideas, at least the prevailing ideas. But and yet we have names of landforms that could only be named if people saw them during volcanic activity.
And what are the origin myths of the Huna tradition?
Well, the legend, my uncle, a Hawaiian uncle, told me, he was one of my main teachers. I can believe this if I want to, because it doesn't really make any difference. But the legend says that it came from the Pleiades in its organized form.
Say that I burned myself, and then I was going to apply some of these principles to that. How do you focus that? Do you concentrate on that patch of skin being whole and unburned? How do you do this?
That's the slow way.
That's the slow way. How do you do this?
The fastest way is to use what we call the repetition technique. And what you do is, if you burn yourself, then as well as you can, you repeat the same movement that caused the burn, but without touching the source.
So if I burned myself on a hot object, then okay, I would...
If you burned yourself, let's say, on a hot pot on the stove.
Okay.
What you would do would be immediately make the same movements toward that pot over and over again without touching the pot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second part, and we usually use... a kind of an affirmation to keep the mind focused, because it's very important to keep your mind off the memory of the first touch. And so we make that, and then to keep the mind focused, we usually say something like, nothing happened. I know that sounds negative, but it works.
So I'm reaching towards the pot, but not touching it, and I'm saying nothing happened.
Same way, without touching it.
Okay.
And keep doing that over and over again.
Okay.
The first thing that will happen, if you do it quickly enough, first thing that will happen is the pain will go away.
Okay.
If you do it quickly enough, there will be no blister and most often not even any redness.
And quickly is important so that you start reprogramming the experience before the blister manifests on the skin.
Now, you can actually do it after the event with imagination of that original experience. Imagine over and over that you never really touched the pot.
Hmm. Interesting.
And that can produce either complete or a considerable degree of healing afterwards.
But it's easier to prevent the blister from happening.
Yeah, it is, right?
Before than removing the blister once it's happened. Okay.
Right.
Interesting. So what are you actually doing when you're doing this repetition technique? You're reimagining.
What you're doing is you are immediately changing your response to the event and your response to your memory of the event. See, body has the capability of healing itself instantly. And the reason it doesn't in so many cases is because of the mind's constant recall of the trauma. which maintains the tension that inhibits the body from completing the healing.
Oh, okay. So you're suggesting that if left to our own devices in a pure state, we would regenerate like a salamander does its limb. It would just sort of repair instantly.
That's right. This is what the body begins to do immediately.
Well, what about animals? You know, animals don't have the same complex natures that we do. They're more simple, more in tune with nature, it would seem. So they get hurt. They take time to heal. Why aren't
they do?
Why don't we see this more in nature?
Well, we have this very incredible tool called our imagination.
So it's just a matter of harnessing that.
Harnessing that, but also this imagination includes, it's all about this ability to focus and shift our focus. Now, with animals, most of the time from most injuries, they heal up quite rapidly, all things considered, because they don't have that constant focus on the past. Uh-huh. When they don't, it's because they also are either mentally or their body is remembering the trauma.
You know,
We can even help with our focus. We can help animals to heal more quickly.
Yeah. Would you consider that animals also have this telepathic ability, at least household pets, and they're
sure
picking up from us just as much as, you know?
Oh,
so
absolutely. Remember I said that there's this constant influence? I would say not just animals, but cars, computers, trees, everything.
So all of it's a reflection of our own everything's a message, you could say. Everything's trying to communicate with us.
Well, I would say everything is communicating with us. We can simply develop our ability to be aware of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it takes as long as it takes for the person to give up the idea that it can't be done.
What's the secret to that?
The secret to that? The real secret of that is to stop doubting.
So maybe testing these out in little ways and building up confidence.
Sure, you can build up confidence that way.
Yep.
You can also have instant confidence when you stop doubting. That's the super fast way to be confident. But that's difficult for a lot of people.
I think it's difficult living in a society that would tell you the reality is much different than what you're describing.
Oh, sure, sure. You usually have to have either an ability to ignore that or a strong motivation to ignore it.
Well, we're out of time, Serge, but I want to say thank you for introducing us to the Huna Way. Any final comments for today?
This is my pleasure, and that the best thing you can do to help yourself and help the world is learn how to love more.
Thank you, Serge King. This has been Conversation for Exploration, and I want to thank you for joining us on our tour around the universe at large here tonight. And join us next time. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.